Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the University of Central Florida, where educators and innovators are partnering to build a bold future for Florida and beyond. From medical research to advances in space travel, UCF students, faculty, and researchers are helping to build the future. More information is at goforlaunch.ucf.edu.
Artemis 2 is go for launch, and reptiles are on the move. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA's Artemis II mission could launch on a flyby flight around the moon from Florida's Kennedy Space Center this week. It'll be the first crewed mission to visit the moon since the final lunar Apollo mission in 1972. And this crew is taking with them some of the most advanced observational instruments, their eyes. We'll speak with Artemis II mission scientist Barbara Cohen about how the crew trains to make specific scientific observations with their eyes and how that will help future missions land on the moon. Plus, here on Earth, NASA's helping giant Galapagos tortoises get back home. The reptiles are being introduced back to one of the islands in the Galapagos, all thanks to NASA data. The reptilian collaboration. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? NASA's Artemis II mission could launch as early as Wednesday. It's the first time a crew will be on board the Orion space capsule, launching on the SLS rocket on a flyby mission around the moon and back. It's a test flight, and a critical one, ahead of future missions that will bring humans to the lunar surface. It's also a chance for scientists to gather new data about the moon. Here to talk about the science of Artemis II is NASA's Barbara Cohen. She's a member of the Artemis II science team. And a note, we taped this conversation Tuesday morning, a day before the launch attempt of the mission. Well, Barbara, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, so super exciting moment. We are on the cusp of the launch of the Artemis II mission, and I'm very excited to talk about the science of this mission. But first, just how are you feeling? You are a project scientist on Artemis, and we're about to see this thing fly. What's going through your mind?
Oh, it's amazing. I have wanted to see people go to the moon for so long. I'm a scientist, and we send robots to the moon and to Mars, but the human eye and the human brain and the human hand are the most capable scientific instruments that we have. So it's just like sending the newest, most latest technology model. We're so excited to see what we can use these instruments for and how the crew are going to interpret what they see.
So once they launch, they're going to spend a little bit of time in low Earth orbit, then make their trip to do a lunar flyby. And my understanding is they are going to be the farthest people to travel beyond the moon. Just can you give us a sense of where they are going in relation to the moon and why that matters for the science?
So the Artemis II mission will spend about a day in Earth orbit, checking out the systems, making sure life support works, making sure that they can pilot the craft, making sure all the systems check out. Then they'll do their translunar injection that gets them out to the moon. Now, they're not going to go into lunar orbit. They're going to stay in the Earth's gravitational influence. So they'll go out past the moon, and then they'll just fall right back to Earth on this free return trajectory. It doesn't use a lot of fuel and comes back to Earth safely. When they go to the moon, they'll be going out past the moon by a pretty significant distance, several thousand kilometers. And when they pass by the far side of the moon, it'll look like a basketball held at arm's length. It'll be that kind of view. So it's much further away than the Apollo astronauts were. But the benefit of that to us, to science, is that kind of like when you're traveling cross country on an airplane, what you can see is a strip of land below you. You don't see the whole globe of the Earth. That's what the Apollo astronauts did. They were very close to the moon and they could really see what was underneath them. The Artemis II astronauts will be able to see it from much farther away, and that means they'll be able to see places on the moon that actually no human eyes have ever seen before. So it's super exciting to have this crew. They've trained so hard with us to be able to see these sites and tell us what they're seeing, and to have the first humans go beyond low Earth orbit in 50 years, including the first person of color, the first woman, and the first non-American.
I love to think that like the most advanced piece of technology that you're sending on this mission is the human eyeballs and those eight eyeballs of the crew, right? I mean, what have you trained them to look for it? And what is that training actually like? You didn't just tell them like, hey, look out the window and tell us what you see.
Well, some of it is that actually.
Okay. Well, I can do that.
But we want them to do it in a way that makes sense to scientists. So we train them up using all the science language that we want, what we're looking for specifically, and how they can look for things that are relevant to us. So this is training for when humans get to land on the moon, and, you know, even when they're orbiting, the specific science instruments or specific science goals that we want them to accomplish. You need the right language. You need to be efficient with your time. You need to make sure that you're sending back the right data. Now, of course, we've had lots of robotic missions to the moon that have taken really detailed images across lots of different wavelengths. So we're not asking them to reproduce the robotic space missions. What we're asking them to do is to help us understand how to best use crew in this situation. Of course, your eyes are in cameras, right? If you and your buddy compare something that you both saw last night at a party or on TV, you're going to give different accounts of that. That's because what comes into your eye doesn't just get fed back out as a video like our robotic exploration does. It gets filtered through your brain. That's a plus and a minus, right? What we want them to do is to filter it through their brain, to use their lifelong experience to be able to compare one thing against another, to be able to process what they're seeing and say, this is interesting because, draw your attention to things. And then to use, in our case, the lunar science team wants them to actually start doing the geology that we want them to do, looking at impact craters, looking at lava flows, understanding what the subtle color variation is, or what the subtle albedo differences are, what's lighter and what's darker, what overlays something else that tells us about timing and stratigraphy. So we want to start training the crew, all of the crew, not just this crew. And so getting that training process in place, understanding what it's like to work with the crew. And then on the other hand, they've got lots of different constraints on their time and attention, of course. They've got to be monitoring all the systems, the mechanical systems, the computer systems, making sure that they are healthy and happy and thriving. So they've got a lot of competition for their attention and their brain power. So how are we training to work in the science that we want alongside all of the other things that they are being asked to do? So those are the kinds of things that we'll be testing for science. But we're really hoping too that we're going to see some very new things. We're going to see these images of the far side of the moon. We're going to get them to be able to talk about what it's like to see the geology of those places.
Barbara, you know, last week on the show, we had two lunar scientists from the University of Central Florida who told me something that I was not aware of. And it's the fact that the moon, actually, the rocks on the moon are different colors. They're not just white and black or gray. Are these Artemis II astronauts going to be close enough to the moon where they would be able to see the differences in color, these subtle differences on the surface of the moon?
We don't know the answer. Now, we're not doing an experiment on what the human eye can and can't perceive, right? We know enough about the human eyeball. Biologists know what the smallest thing you can resolve is. We know that rocks are different colors. When you see the disk of the moon, there are very, very subtle color variations that have been mapped by robotic spacecraft. Or if you take a picture of the moon, actually, if you go out and take a picture of the moon at night and really stretch that color, you can see some differences. But with your eye, it's unlikely that they'll be able to perceive those differences, but we honestly don't know. It's going to be very bright in some places. It's going to be right up against a very dark sky. Again, our eyes are not just cameras, right? Okay. We're going to be staring at places. Maybe that will cause them to perceive color differences. We're going to be looking at what they say, and then we can compare that against the images, robotic images, images that they take to try to understand what they were perceiving. And that'll be really, really important on the surface of the moon because, like you said, if they can perceive a color difference that we wouldn't be able to otherwise, that's going to give us bonus science.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Barbara Cohen. She is a member of NASA's Artemis II Lunar Science Team. We're talking about the science of Artemis II ahead of its possible launch on Wednesday. Can you tell us what science you hope to gather from this Artemis II mission?
There is a huge range of science that's going up on this mission. Now, Artemis I also had some instruments inside the cabin to understand the cabin's atmosphere and acceleration forces, things like that. We're going to have a lot of those be remanifested on Artemis II so that we can understand the radiation environment, you know, the crew cabin environment, temperature, humidity, things like that. Not only important for the crew's health, but also for the health and well-being of any instruments that we put into that space or any samples that we're eventually going to return. We're going to be looking at the health and safety of the crew themselves. So there's the human research program at NASA is going to be looking at those kinds of things, what their respiration rates are like, their oxygen intake is like, things like that. Those crew members donated some of their own cells before the flight, some of their plasma cells. Those got put into an instrument called the Avatar. It's tissue on a chip. And so we can take their tissues, their actual cells, and we can put them into places on the Orion capsule, or even, you know, in nooks and crannies that humans wouldn't be living in, but have more extreme environments. So we can understand how their cells would react to those environments. That's going to help understand what those cells go through and maybe get some more personalized medicine or countermeasures for crew in the future. And then, of course, we have our lunar science observations, and I'm on the team for that. Those lunar science observations, we put together a whole list, schedule, actually, of things that we want them to look at on the moon. Now, they'll be going around the far side. Those are places that we can't see from the Earth. We only have seen them from robotic missions, as we mentioned. So we have a list of targets. We figured out what targets we wanted them to look at, and not only just which ones to look at, but how to look at them. So you don't just want them to look at this, look at that, look at the other thing. We want them to maybe look at four craters in a row and compare them to each other. We want them to be able to find different places on the moon by trailing their eye along the terminator. We want them to really see what color this mare is versus that mare. So we put together this plan. We guided them through the observations that we want them to make. We've trained the crew on that several times. We've done simulations. So they are very well trained. And actually, some of them are extremely excited about being able to give us these views.
Finally, Barbara, something that mission specialist Christina Cook mentioned when she was speaking with media on Sunday was she was asked about the why of these Artemis missions and why go back to the moon. And she mentioned that the moon could hold that or start helping us better answer that question of are we alone here, because the moon itself is a witness plate, a Rosetta Stone, as she mentioned. You know, Barbara, just how important is understanding the moon to understanding our place in the universe, and how much do we even know about the moon, and what is there yet to learn? I know that was a very lengthy question for you, but
it encompasses all of lunar science over the decades, and I'm glad you asked. We have so much more to learn on the moon. The Apollo missions really introduced us to planetary science as a field. They were the first time that we were able to go to another body, return samples, understand the geology that they came from. We've been able to take all of that experience and go across the solar system with robots, but to Mars and to Mercury and to the outer planets, and grow up planetary science as a field, understand how our solar system formed and what the Earth's place is in it. So what we know now that we didn't know when we sent the Apollo missions is that the Earth and the moon formed together. We had a giant impact event very early in Earth's history where two bodies collided, formed, remelted the Earth, formed the moon. So kind of time zero started then for the Earth and the moon together. We've been co-evolving in this space ever since. So everything that's happened to the Earth in terms of space has happened to the moon. But the Earth, of course, has plate tectonics. It's covered with oceans. We recycle our crust. We have wind and weather. We don't have that on the moon. So everything that happened in our past is recorded on the moon. And so we just have to go there to find it. Some of the cool things that we can do with the Artemis missions in particular, going to the poles of the moon, is that there are deep, dark craters there that have been cold for a really long time. When you have cold craters, they can collect things that get contributed, like by comets and asteroids. So water, ammonia, things like that that come in over time. And that tells us the time history of things that have been hitting the moon. What were they? When did they come in? And so that to me is one of the more exciting things. I'm very interested in the history of things whizzing around the solar system and colliding with each other.
We just have to, as you say, go there and find it.
Find it. We have to touch it. We have to lick it. We have to bring it home with us.
Well, and that may happen starting on Wednesday. Barbara Cohen is a member of the Artemis II Lunar Science Team. Thank you so much for joining us, Barbara.
It's absolutely my pleasure, Brendan. Thanks.
Still to come, a look at how NASA data is helping reptiles here on Earth.
So we are a space agency, but because of that, we take a planetary scale view at observing phenomena around the planet. And we track things like weather, temperature, water resources, and vegetation cover, all of which are incredibly informative for lots of different fields, but especially for conservation.
Moving Galapagos tortoises, that's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. For decades, scientists have been trying to answer the question, could there be life on one of Earth's neighboring planets? Rovers on Mars are now one step closer to answering that question. We'll dive into the latest discovery from the Red Planet. That's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about life a little closer to home. Reptiles. And not just any reptiles. We're talking about Galapagos tortoises. For the first time in 150 years, NASA data is helping reintroduce these giant tortoises to the Floriana Island in the Galapagos. Using this data, Galapagos National Park Directorate and Galapagos Conservancy are helping to rewild over 150 tortoises. Are We There Yet? Marion Summerall spoke with Keith Gaddis. He's the manager for NASA's Earth Action Biological Diversity and Ecological Forecasting Program. They talked about these giant animals and the collaboration to reintroduce them to the island. Here's that conversation now.
Keith, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. I'm really excited because we're talking about some really cool reptiles, the giant Galapagos tortoises. Not turtles, tortoises. I'd like to make that distinction for somebody who doesn't know what's happening with these Galapagos tortoises.
Yeah, they are endemic, meaning they're native to these islands. And actually, each island has its own unique species. If you've ever read anything about Darwin, they're one of these species that it's an area that's quintessential for tracking evolutionary patterns, because you have this island layout and species have become locally adapted to each of the islands in that archipelago. And so just like the finches, Darwin's finches have adapted to the islands, so have the tortoises. And because of multiple factors, one thing that sailors historically used to use these tortoises as food when they'd stop over, and then you've had introduction of invasive species that have outcompeted the tortoises on certain islands, their populations have rapidly declined over centuries, really, to the place where on some of the islands they've become locally extinct. And so this has been huge conservation concern in terms of, you have just these species that are unique and only exist on these islands. They're also incredibly important just for the ecosystems themselves. They're like almost like beavers in that they're ecosystem engineers. And so by them being in place on certain islands, they help to protect other species that are dependent on the environment. And so there's been a group of folks that have been working to both build back up the populations of existing tortoises on these islands and have been trying to rewild them to islands where they've become locally extinct. And that's where this project has fit in, to try to help them to do that in an informed way.
NASA is helping in all this, which you would think, when you think of NASA, you think it's a space agency, right? You are thinking rocket launches, you are thinking being in outer space, right? You're not thinking about the agency is helping with these tortoises. So let's talk about it. How is NASA a part of all this?
Yeah, it's all, you know, often when I talk to people, they're really surprised by the program that I manage and are often, you know, think, wow, is this really within NASA's domain? But honestly, it's a perfect place because we can deliver on the promise that we have to society of trying to improve the lives and livelihoods of people around the world and just improve the planet as a whole. So we are a space agency, but because of that, we take a planetary scale view at observing phenomena around the planet. And we track things like weather, temperature, water resources, and vegetation cover, all of which are incredibly informative for lots of different fields, but especially for conservation. And so in this case, we have used NASA's assets and long history of 60 years of observations to identify the areas in which these tortoises thrive, like where their food's going to be optimal, where the surrounding environment is optimal for them to nest. And also, based on these 60 years of data that we've gathered, we've built these forecasts of how the future is going to look environmentally in this area, so we can select areas that not only are currently optimal, but will remain so into the future, so that if we invest in repopulating these individuals on these islands, that we're sure that they're going to survive into the future.
And this data, so you said it's been collected over 60 years. Is this satellite data? You know, what kind of data is this? I'm trying to like picture it in my mind.
Yeah, so it's a combination of assets. You know, one of the big ones that they're using in this is Landsat, which is one of our best instruments for tracking, just taking pictures of the Earth at a regular cadence since the 1970s. And from that, you can estimate land surface temperature, but more importantly for these guys, you can see greenness and actually see the cover of vegetation and the types of vegetations that are being constructed or composed in different environments. So that's what helps us identify areas where there's lots of lush vegetation that these tortoises can eat.
And so when did this kind of collaboration start? I mean, was it NASA kind of noticed it, or was it these people who are trying to reestablish the tortoises there? Like, where did this all get started?
The program that I run, effectively how we operate, is that we put out these calls for activities to leverage NASA data to inform all kinds of decision making. And so they actually came to us and said, hey, we'd like to partner with you and you leverage NASA assets. We have this project underway to restore these tortoises onto this island where they haven't occurred for 200 years. But we want to make sure that we're being careful in doing that. So we'd love to partner with you, build out a capability to inform and build out these maps to map the optimal environment in which we can rewild these tortoises onto the island. So that's how it basically happened. And we've provided support to researchers and scientists across the country to aid in building out technology to inform this activity.
And again, you mentioned earlier, right, your job. Most people don't think that NASA has any involvement with things that really happen on Earth. I mean, you're helping reestablish a species. How does that feel for you as well, too?
Oh, my goodness. I have two little girls, and I love nothing more than to go home at the end of the day and say that Daddy was part of a project that helped to save giant tortoises in Galapagos. And I mean, the other thing is, it's just inspiring because this is just the tip of the iceberg. Because this is basically like a demonstration project to show how using NASA assets can lead to more positive, beneficial outcomes than had the data not been previously available. We've got projects around the globe looking at other rewilding efforts for beavers in North America, to tigers in Southeast Asia, lions in Africa, bison in North America. This is basically a demonstration of capability to build trust within stakeholders to also use NASA assets. I mean, there's this wealth of resources around conservation, but it's not unlimited. And so we have to use our resources and capabilities in a strategic way to have a maximum impact. And so it's inspiring to see this happening and working, you know, very well, so that we can do more of these efforts into the future.
We keep talking about a term, rewilding, and I kind of want to jump into that. What does that mean, and what does that mean for these tortoises, right? Are you just, when you say that, are you like, are these tortoises being, you know, nurtured somewhere and then brought here? Kind of just, what does that mean?
Yeah, they're bred in captivity. And in fact, they were identifying individuals that had the greatest genetic signature of the individuals that used to be on that island of Floriana. And so what they did is they bred these in captive on a separate island. And then again, they having to be very careful before they took these individuals and literally helicoptered them over to another island to release them. They wanted to be absolutely sure that they had the greatest likelihood of surviving once they got there. And so that's where the NASA assets come in to inform, make sure that's actually possible. But rewilding is huge. I mean, it's basically you have not just tortoises, but like I said, other species who get what we call extirpated or knocked out or locally extinct from a given area. And we're trying to reintroduce those individuals into that environment. And especially for species like the tortoise that are ecosystem engineers that go in and transform these areas with invasive plant species and turn them back into natural grasslands where other species that are native to that environment can thrive. It's incredibly important. They're a keystone species and they help these other species to survive there.
This is not only important for these islands, but how is it just important for people, right? I mean, we talk about all the time that NASA is looking to the stars. We talk about habitats on the moon, right? We talk about even one day living on Mars. But your efforts is kind of healing our planet here. And I think that there's something really interesting in that too.
Yeah. In addition to, you know, obviously, again, like it's easy for me to sell this to my daughters at home in that we're saving these tortoises and the value they provide. But there's practical benefits of this. Again, you're saving the native species that exist on this environment, not just the tortoises, but the other species that are dependent on them. And also the other huge thing is that the Galapagos are dependent on tourism as one of the primary economic sources for that area. And people literally fly in from around the world to see these guys. And so that's like what, like a $2 billion enterprise going on that island. And so by helping to save these tortoises, we're helping improve the lives and livelihoods of the people that live on the Galapagos themselves.
This may be a silly question, but how is NASA benefiting from this as well? I mean, is it just that collaboration of helping here on our own planet? You know, walk me a little bit through that too.
I mean, one thing I would say is that I feel great about my program because of the outcomes that it has. But ultimately, it benefits NASA because even if I'm working with somebody who doesn't care at all about conservation, other people around the globe do. And we're trying to advance the use and leverage of NASA assets. So that brings people to the table who might not previously have used our data. And we're dependent on what we call in situ or on the ground observations to calibrate our instruments that we're measuring. So an activity like this in such a unique environment allows us to identify how to build models to forecast not just the patterns and behaviors of the tortoises on this island, but then we can then scale that out to how we track patterns and behaviors of species around the globe. So it's a huge benefit back to NASA by getting access to, you know, years and decades of data that have been gathered on the ground on the Galapagos by partnering with these agents. And in the end, we ultimately do something that's great for people and the environment.
And it is great for those tortoises too. And I want to wrap up this conversation. How are the tortoises that have been rewilded? How are they doing?
Waiting with bated breath. I mean, again, this is the first step in a longer activity. So we haven't completely crossed the finish line, but obviously we've set them up for success and, you know, we're hoping for their long-term survival and recovery.
And how many were introduced?
I believe it was 150.
150. Wow. Keith, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about this collaboration and give an update on these tortoises and the ecosystem. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Keith Gaddis, the manager for NASA's Earth Actions Biological Diversity and Ecological Forecasting Program, speaking with Are We There Yet's Marion Summerall. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed and never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.